You're listening to The Stack, first broadcast on the 15th of June 2013 on Monocle 24.
A blustery morning here in London, tables artfully arranged with the finest magazines, two guests here in studio, and an outside broadcast of sorts. From Beirut to Bermondsey, Stockholm to Sapporo, this is edition 42 of The Stack. And from farm animals to fine journalism, this is going to be a very rarefied and rural edition of The Stack. London and Beirut don't seem so detached when it comes to editing a good piece of print, as we'll be joined by two guests that know the magazine world inside out. We also have our very own live kiosk just beyond our studio with Mag Culture curating the mix.
We've got a range of independent magazines, some of the big hitters of the genre, if you like.
That was our very own magman, Jeremy Leslie, telling us what's on offer, and we'll discover or rediscover a very British feeling.
It was a project that started through my train journeys to and fro for my commuting, an idea which grew out of a fondness and a want to be able to talk about the stories of craft behind products and objects.
All that and much more over the next 50 minutes or so, live from the Country Fair here at Marjorie House in London, right here on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to edition 42 of The Stack here on Monocle 24. I'm Tyler Brulé. Well, it's all go here at Midori House this morning as nations and haberdashers, baristas and graphic designers scurry about preparing for our second annual Monocle Country Fair. If you're just rolling out of bed here in London or heading to the capital, it all kicks off in our courtyard just as we go off air and runs over the next 2 days. In addition to stall holders like Honest John's Records, Kitsune and Trunk Clothiers, we've also called upon regular Stack commentator Jeremy Leslie to offer up his favourite periodicals for perusing and hopefully purchase. We'll be jumping outside the studio in a moment to talk to him, but first let's meet our guests around the table here in Studio One. And welcome around the table here in Studio One. First, a voice probably quite familiar to many of our listeners is just sitting off to my left. Our Beirut correspondent, who is sort of via South Kensington correspondent at the moment as well. We need someone in that part of the world. Carol Corm is here. Welcome.
Hi, Tyler.
What's been keeping you busy? I know that there is something of a launch and signing coming up, aside from your duties you've been doing for us and others, something maybe a little bit weightier as well in the mix.
Yeah, definitely. I won't say what.
Don't be so coy. It must be on press, no?
It's coming.
Okay. When we last were out in Beirut, you've set up something of an imprint right now. I guess just before we went on air, we were talking about, the state of where Lebanon is at the moment. Just tell us a little bit, though, about why you decided to resurrect or kick off a publishing imprint.
Well, my family's always been in publishing, and my grandfather started this great publishing house in 1920 when Lebanon was still figuring out what it wanted to be after the Ottoman Empire. And so we resurrected his publishing house with my father, who's a bit obsessed with archives, who's passed
yes,
on
as,
the,
as we've noticed,
yeah,
yes.
He's passed on the bug to me. And then this publishing house was in French. And I wanted to do something in English, and I also didn't want to always ask my father if he approved or not. So I started a little sister to that imprint, which is called Daria Press, and it's more on guides. Unfortunately, guides on the Middle East right now are not in high demand, so I'm switching to more lucrative fields or topics.
Tell me, just when you speak to friends and colleagues out in Beirut at the moment, in the media field, and maybe not just people covering it, but also people who are really, running, media outlets there. What is the mood right now? I mean, I think we all, of course, we can see what's happening across the border, but also, even within the city limits of Beirut as well. What's sort of the feeling?
Well, it's tense, and the economy's bad, and we're kind of this wait-and-see situation. It's lasted 2 years already with Syria around the corner. There's also a bit of schizophrenia, which is typical of the Lebanese, but I guess that's how you continue to start off projects. There's still parties, there's still weddings, there's still new magazines. Life has to go on. But I mean, it's difficult because people are being killed and massacred 2 hours away, and now it's seeping through.
Mm. Well, we'll probably revisit that theme maybe a little bit as the program goes on. Seated to my right as well, James Wright is here, and you've got something of a new project in the form of a title called "So It Goes," maybe you wanted to define it. I mean, it's a really interesting, when I sort of flip through it, wonderful production values, which is always a good start, but a mix of. Contemporary art, I think really outstanding photography. Where would you say you sit in the marketplace for anyone who's listening who hasn't seen the magazine yet?
Well, I think when we started out, it was off the back of a publication called Fourth and Main Journal that I had edited for 3 years, which was a free and kind of democratically distributed title, which went into a kind of clutch of galleries and cultural institutions and boutiques. And the feedback we were getting over the course of the time we were in circulation was that it was a title that deserved to be a paid publication. And so we decided to give it its own life force. And I think it occupies a kind of cross-cultural remit. It is a general interest title. And there are 7 chapters across the artistic disciplines. So we have a section on the actors, directors, artists, musicians, and a longer form section at the back called the writers. So I think that there is a gap in the market for a group of people between 21 and 35 who aren't necessarily being catered for by lots of the specialist titles that are coming out, like the food titles, like the Gourmand and Cereal, which do what they do fantastically. But when we look at the newsstand, we didn't see a title that gave a little bit for everyone. I think that if you are drawn towards longer form journalism, which is something we're very much looking to champion, with the chapter at the back that has longer form political and cultural commentary pieces. And if you're drawn to the more visually geared chapters like the artists and like the actors, I think there's something in it for everyone.
Now, as I said at the top of the program, and of course we'll be coming back to you, James, in a moment as well, and of course going through all of the titles that you've brought in today. But I also mentioned that, of course, we've got the Country Fair. It's all being set up just beyond our studio walls here right now. Our David Pleasant is out on the floor. There's probably sort of a lot of buzz and noise. And as we said, we heard, of course, from Jeremy Leslie at the top of the program. He's a regular contributor to the show and, of course, is the gentleman behind Mag Culture. David, maybe just paint the scene, because of course we're in the wool-wrapped walls of Studio One. What's happening out there?
Quite the opposite here, Tyler. It's all go. There's lots of action, everyone unpacking. Jeremy here is calm as a cucumber. He has set up his stall, and let's go to Jeremy. Jeremy has set up Mag Culture, and tell us what we have here in front of us.
Well, it's the Mag Culture shop. It's an experiment, to be honest. I've been working in magazines one way or the other for the last sort of 20 years or so, primarily designing them. But I've also, alongside that, been observing the magazine scene quite closely through a series of books and through my Mag Culture blog, which has become a source of information about, in particular, the independent scene. But I like to think it covers a broader range of magazines. And an obvious extension of the blog has been to start selling magazines online. I've been doing that for about a year now, quite successfully. And it was a very interesting opportunity when Monocle invited me to have a stall here to actually set up a shop and meet some of the people that buy magazines and find out more about the actual hard side of publishing.
Do you think there's a bit of a gap in the market in terms of outlets for high quality magazines? Do you think there is one place in London that you can really find them all in one place?
I don't think there is one place. I think there are a number of very good magazine stores. My personal ambition is to open the store that I think London deserves. And that is a store that ranges from the kind of the smaller independent titles that I'm selling here today and that are doing very exciting things editorially and design-wise, but also from there to some right across all the magazines and present a kind of flagship for the industry, if you like. I think that London does, it's not to say London doesn't have good magazine stores. There are some very good independent stores selling some of the magazines that I sell online, and there are some very good mainstream news agents. But I'd like to see a shop that combined both and became the definitive store for London.
And let's talk about the spread that we have. It's a wonderful, colourful spread on a very stylish black background. C- Can you tell us some of the titles?
Yeah, sure. Well, we've got quite a range of magazines from the independent sector, from some of the kind of genre leaders like Apartamento, Fantastic Man and Gentlewoman, I Magazine and Anorak magazines that have already proved their lasting ability. They're around and they're around for the future as well, very successful in their own right. And then there's a lot of newcomers, and we're particularly excited to have new magazines, new issues of magazines like Printed Pages from It's Nice That. The wine magazine Noble Rot was a recent discovery, and they've just published their second issue, and we're excited to have that. And we've got The Gourmand. The second issue of The Gourmand is just out, and I haven't even had a look at it myself, but we've got it in the shop, and I hope, if it's not too busy today, to be able to have a flick through that.
And do you, when you sell magazines, do you encourage people to flick through, or does it slightly irritate you? Are you kind of a bit wary of people thumbing the pages and ruining the stock?
I'll have to tell you that in about an hour's time after I've done it for a while. But joking aside, I think it's really important. One of the key things about magazines is the ability to flick and feel and touch. And of course, people are welcome to come and flick through.
Okay. Well, let's hope they will. We better go back to the studio. Tyler, over to you.
Thanks, David, very much for that. Carol, Noble Rot sounds like a magazine just perfect for your aperitivo, which I understand kicks off every day at 1700.
I've turned into an alcoholic, but I was wondering, does Decanter still exist or no?
I think Decanter does exist. Why is that?
I was just thinking wine. It's true. It's a niche. Maybe someone should do something really chic and a bit independent for wine. You know, like they've done it for food. Why not do something like that for wine?
Yeah, you sort of see, like, yeah, as you said, Decanter, and there's, you know...
Decanter is not, but it's too, like, mainstream.
But it is, but I think that, you know, there's almost a whole sector which is also, ripe for reinvention, because I think we always talk about sort of this new sort of self-published sort of movement that's going on, which, you know, can sometimes be a little bit sort of precious and rarefied. And then, you know, sometimes you do sort of crave, actually, something which is just a bit... gloss and commercial. And it's one thing I sort of noticed when I was in the US last week, that there's that peculiar genre of you know, these US city magazines, you know, which, you know, where they focus on, well, we're in, you know, Seattle and Portland, everything, but they haven't changed for 30 years. They haven't sort of kept up with sort of, you know, really what's happened in publishing. And yet they only sort of need sort of like a very, very gentle dust down. I wanted to just pick up though on what Jeremy was saying about, you know, purchasing magazines, and it's just interesting when he talks about, you know, he would love to sort of do that perfect store. And I think that despite, you know, the array of great shops, and of course we have, you know, Magma comes on here as well. I mean, you know, they do a very good job, but, you know, sometimes it's maybe a bit narrow in parts. Carol, what is a, are you a subscription person? Do you prefer if they sort of, you know, make the way up into your apartment, or do you prefer going and having a big trawl, you know, somewhere in South Ken?
Well, my issue,
you do have one of the better newsstands, you know, in London, not too far from
here. In the Serpentine.
Yeah.
I have an issue because since I got married, my husband hates subscriptions, hates having lots of magazines around. And
this is a problem.
This is a serious problem because I love it and I grew up with, I mean, my family was subscribed to every possible magazine in the world. So I kind of sneak in magazines. I have to hide. I do subscribe, but like I try and like send them to his parents-in-law, and then I take them from there. It's a complicated issue, but I'm a bit of both. I mean, the excitement also of going to the kiosk, especially now that I have a baby, and so I have to find activities with the pram. So like going to the kiosk is one of them, and each week going and getting, for instance, now I'm hooked to Bloomberg Business Week, that it's kind of exciting to go and buy it. But yeah, I should go to the Serpentine. I don't. I go to grubby kiosks. But
I wanted to ask you though, this issue that your husband has with print. Is it just an issue of sort of disarray, and he doesn't want, you know, large towers of titles all over? Is it order issue?
It's a clutter issue, and I love paper. I love having lots of magazines around. It's like, oh, you just. It's just ego having all these magazines around.
He must have a heart attack when he goes and visits your father's archive.
He does.
I wanted to just sort of to talk about when your purchase habits as well. Do you prefer the, you know, the thud of something dropping through the letterbox, or is it?
Well, My family's home for years was always checkered with towers of subscriptions for magazines, so that's something I've grown up with. But for me, part of the beauty of finding a new title is doing that organically and going to a newsstand and picking up something and rifling through for 15 or 20 minutes and finding some undiscovered gem that I've never heard of before. I was in Artwords on Rivington Street the other day, and I came across three or four titles that I'd never previously heard of, one called Optology, which was completely beautiful, which is a new photographic journal that's come out. And I think there's great joy to be found in that experience. As much as I like to, you know, rely upon the fact that on a certain day I'll be receiving my favorite title through the post, there's still a thrill that comes from that. But part of it for me is, yeah, the exploration in finding new titles.
Any of those new journals that you discovered in Rivington Street, are they in your stack?
They are here, okay. Indeed, yeah. The first is number 7, the issue 7 of The White Review, which is a literary journal that I think is actually quite special. It was edited by Ben Eastham and Jack Testard, and I think what they've done is very bold, just playing with the form. I think tonally and aesthetically it's rather special, because, you know, in this day and age with everyone bemoaning the death of print media, what they've done is put out a literary journal that is, you know, issuing lots of the naysayers by putting something out with no imagery. It is literary criticism, but it also touches upon art review, essays, poetry, and I just think it's beautifully curated. There's a pared back aesthetic that I think is really rather wonderful and kind of flawless in the way it's edited beautifully as well.
I mean, it's a title which, of course, has come up from time to time as well. Its position in the marketplace, because, you know, of course, you know, on the other side, you have the ongoing expansion of Granta, for example, as well. You're seeing it sort of moving into so many other markets as well, various sort of language editions. I want to go back to when you launched your title, and you talked about sort of this 21 to 35-year-old demographic. I guess, why, you know, well, two things also. Where are you sitting frequency-wise right now?
We're going to be a biannual title, partly because of the fact that we are a team of two. Always have been at the previous publication I worked at, so we have a limited capacity as to how many issues we can put out a year.
How do you supplement that? I mean, a lot of people would say that, you know, biannual, given short attention spans, and that, you know, people are very promiscuous on the newsstand, etc. How are you able to build up a level of loyalty?
Well, previously we had an online editorial platform with Fourth and Main, which maintained a kind of ongoing dialogue with our readership. So we put out three articles across art, design, fashion, culture, film, music. And we intend to do a similar thing to maintain that dialogue with people over the course of the 6-month circulation. So that if there is a loyalty when it comes to the print publication, that we can maintain that and develop an ongoing trust with our reader and develop a community around the publication, which I think is very important.
Well, we'll discuss more of your finds, of course, and also talk about your title as well. Hopefully we'll get Carol to disclose also some more of her plans a little bit later. In the meantime, though, you are listening to The Stack here on Monocle 24. We're going away for a shortish break. We're back in a moment.
The Review is Monocle 24's weekly review and preview of the arts. Every Saturday, we take a relaxed look back at the books, TV shows, films, music, theatre, and events that have made our week, while looking around the corner to scout out the next big thing.
It doesn't feel sappy, it doesn't feel sentimental, it does have a certain heft.
It's very Darwinian. The shows that do well run and the ones that don't close, and there have been some quite high-profile flops and some great successes as well.
For me, it's riotous, it's tasteless, but it's actually dynamic as well, it has momentum.
Join Monocle's editors as they sit down with our favourite critics, opinion makers and key industry figures for some in-depth discussion and lively debate. And we provide inspiration for the weekend from cities around the world.
It's a real divider, because I know some people just love this film and other people really just hate it.
That's A Review, every Saturday at midday London time and across the weekend, right here on Monocle 24.
And you're back with the Stack here on Monocle 24. It's also Country Fair Day, which starts in about 36 minutes. But before we went to the break, we were just talking about consumption habits of magazines and, of course, with our two guests who are here in the studio right now. Carol, I'm wondering, when you look at, and, you know, of course, you have a past in more commercial titles and, of course, you know, working with us, and then you're now moving into having your own imprint as well. And splitting your time between sort of Beirut and London, and London, where oftentimes the barrier for entry is so high. I mean, to do anything, it's so expensive. And I think when you've taken us around Beirut, it's incredible to see that people still have quite amazing presses. And I mean, you can get things made very quite easily. Do you find a frustration when you're here, and do you still sort of see yourself using Lebanon not just as a manufacturing base, but also as a point of inspiration as you grow your imprint as well?
Yeah, I just feel that in Lebanon there's still a lot to be done. So there's more things to fill. Here everything's kind of been done, and it is harder to get into things. Lebanon, the printer, the printer's father used to work with your grandfather. There's that relationship, which is invaluable. And there's a certain ease about doing things. People are more helpful. I mean, sometimes it doesn't work. It's not always perfect. And sometimes it's actually more expensive, I'm starting to realize, than doing something here by email in a printing house outside of London. But you lose that the personal touch, which is, I need something. I need a tote bag. I call the graphic designer. She'll do it in half a day. It'll be printed, and tomorrow I have it. There's that kind of ease, and it's not too expensive, that you don't have here.
Mm. I mean, we're often quite, I wouldn't say careful, but sometimes we think about the region when we're editing the magazine, and I'll think of sort of an incident where we had the Israeli, let's call them sort of rescue forces on the cover. I mean, this was sort of a force for good. This is a disaster relief team. It seems sort of fine, but of course, here we saw that this was an issue that was sort of banned all over the region, etc. I want to just focus for a moment on when you're a publisher. I mean, how much do you have to pay attention to the authorities, or is it a case in Lebanon right now? The government has so much to worry about that it's not too much of an issue.
Well, actually, it is a little bit, because the government is so weak on the important issues, protecting the border, security,
they have
reigning
to be
in
to be
Hezbollah.
Doing something.
Yeah, so they actually focus on the little things. Like some poor guy will come up with a play that like 200 people are going to see, and he's going to get into trouble, or some magazine, or so censorship is a bit of an issue.
Mm. Let's delve into the titles. I can see that you've got one of my favorite titles. I can also thank you because you gave me a copy for a subscription for my birthday.
Oh, I forgot about
Merci.
That.
Thank you very much. Tell us about your first magazine you have there.
Okay, my first one's Cornucopia, which is a beautiful magazine just on Turkey. It's not trendy. It's just beautiful. It's made between Istanbul and Scotland, actually. And it's just, even if you're not interested in Turkey, you'll get interested in Turkey by reading the articles. There's a lovely cooking section. I'm not really a cook, but I got into it. It's just very beautiful. It does its own thing. There's a proverb in Arabic that says, "The dogs might bark, but the caravan continues." And this is a little bit what this magazine does. It doesn't really care about the trends. It's very it knows what it's doing, and it's not influenced by what's going on around it.
No, I think it's a wonderful testament to how you create a really dependable print brand. And I'm not sure, I think has it been going for at least
a
decade?
A while,
it's a while. And I always try to pick up every copy I can, and thank you for the subscription. But I like it because it's I think something just very dependable about it, and yet they're always peeling back a layer of the country. They've always discovered a great artist.
Yeah, they really. I mean, they do a great job because they unearth beautiful things that I'm sure lots of Turks don't know about. They really go beyond Istanbul. They'll show you. There was an issue about these little huts that looked like Swiss chalets, like in the middle of Anatolia. Mm. They were just amazing. And they do. I would love to do something like that for the Levant when things calm down a bit.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. I think there's definitely a Levantine magazine to be done. But I'm looking at a story here, and it's the Yalta playground. It says, you know, the trolley bus route from Simferopol to Yalta, you know, is the longest in the world. And it just, it's, I like how they embrace sort of the region. I think, as you said, it's, you know, it's Turkey and, yeah, and it is, you know, probably the sort of the former reaches of the Ottoman Empire, which is absolutely fantastic.
And the design is beautiful. Impeccable.
Does your husband allow these they can linger around?
Because it's only three times or four times a year, so it's allowed.
It must be nice having your own household censor as well. James, what did you want to? I mean, we can discuss the review further, or is there something else that from one of your discoveries this week?
I actually brought in an issue of Little White Lies, which is a title that I've always respected, partly because I think the prospective readership for film review and commentary is so large, but it's a very staid and kind of rigid section of the marketplace, dominated by either the industry titles like Variety or Hollywood Reporter or Screen, or Empire and Total Film. And there's kind of been no innovation in that field. And I look at Little White Lies and I think about what they're doing, you know, from a typographic perspective, from a design perspective, but also their approach to content and film review and commentary.
The one that you've got there.
Sure. And it's surprising to me that more publications haven't surfaced to challenge the dominance of kind of more commercial mass market publications like Empire and Total Film. And I think Little White Lies breaks the mold a little bit. I can't say I'm a fan of the kind of hot pink typesetting in this issue. But by and large, I think it's quite brave for people looking for kind of filmic commentary that's a little bit more diverse and forward-thinking.
I mean, do you think they're looking for commentary, or are they looking for using it as a resource as well? And I say resource because, you know, just, you know, the volume of, you know, of great foreign films that come out. I always find that's the difficult thing, that, you know, it's oftentimes you're flying on Singapore Airlines or Cathay Pacific. That's actually it's a better place to actually you know, go and see all of those films that, you know, only end up being in Soho here for like 2 days, and then they're gone. So what role do you think Little White Lies fills in the marketplace?
I think that, you know, it's a prism through which people can interact with titles that they might not otherwise have heard of. You know, you might get a small paragraphy review of Empire on, say, Olivia Sassayas' film, Something in the Air, whereas this devotes a page to it and it dissects it in great detail, and it's very kind of probing analysis on the title. And I think it's for people who are looking for something a little more ambitious when it comes to film criticism and commentary. And that feeds into the design and the layout and the type. I don't think it's limited to people who are just there to look for the release of this Friday or the coming month or DVD releases. It says a little bit more than that.
Carol, do you see a role for something like that in your diet, or, and I guess, you know, maybe taking a step back from that as well, do you seek out film reviews?
I kind of read the ones in The New Yorker, but it doesn't go much further than that. But I was thinking of the French.
You can't beat a good Anthony Lane.
Yeah, you can't. The Cahiers du Cinéma, the French cinema thing that's also been going, I think it was started by Truffaut or something.
New Wave.
And it's such a classic. I think that maybe there isn't a classic like that in the English language.
Mm, absolutely, I agree.
What is the journal hiding over there, Carol? I can't see what you have next in your stack.
I have two. I have what one would you prefer? Aramco. This is the oil company's magazine. Aramco, the Saudi American oil company, and this also has existed for years. This is kind of like the Smithsonian magazine. Mm. They just do a magazine that's free, and they distribute it to the entire Middle East almost. I mean, I used to get this as a kid. My husband's family also. Everyone receives it.
Yeah.
Oops. And it's just a, you know, general culture about the Middle East. It's a way to promote, basically, Aramco. But they do a good job. It's very educative, and it's nice mainstream articles, but it's just been there for so long, and it's part of a lot of Middle Easterns. I mean, it's just there in everyone's house. And
This has come up before, and in fact, I only ever saw copies of it online, but copies from like the 1970s, probably,
yeah,
which are
exactly.
Really amazing.
Yeah,
I mean, they remind you of Nova magazine and you know, women skiing in Iran and all kind. I mean, and I think also capturing a very different Middle
there was
East
like
as well.
An issue on Miss Lebanon in 1971. She was the cover because she became Miss Universe, and it just captures the. It has something. I don't know. I can't put my finger on it, but it's not trendy. It's not cool.
No, I mean, it's the less handsome cousin of Cornucopia. But, I mean, how do they, is it sort of, it's obviously it's a controlled distribution. I mean, I've never seen it on newsstands.
So no, it but just they gets distribute sent, it free. Like, if you say you want a subscription, they'll subscribe you. Anyone can get it, and they're big in schools and things like that. But it's actually, they do a good, serious job. You know, they'll have this one is on the marshes in Iraq and actually learn stuff, and it's not pretentious.
You know, there's a great story here. Nothing sort of really hangs together from an art direction point of view, which is interesting because the older issues, that I saw online do. But it's the forgotten apogee of Lebanese rocketry. 52 years ago, Soviet cosmonauts and U.S. astronauts were first venturing into space. Another space program was also taking off. In Lebanon.
Yeah, it's true. And if you look at the back cover, there's a very nice painting on the back of the magazine.
Yeah, it's a little bit Tintin with the Cedar du Liban.
It was an Armenian university. They did it as like a hobby. They had this science club, and they launched rockets. And then the government took interest, and someone just did a movie on them. So that's why it's resurfacing now.
No, it's of course, at least Southern Lebanon is known for rockets of another type.
Let's not talk about those are depressing.
We won't talk about those. But it's this is interesting. I don't know if you've seen this, James, before, but it's I mean, do you think it's what role does it play? I mean, do you see this as a bit of a propaganda vehicle for Aramco? But and I'm wondering how far do they push it as well? Because it's.
I mean, there's never any politics in it. It's very friendly, there's nothing controversial about it. But, it celebrates the culture of the Middle East, and we kind of need that, so.
And it is truly pan-regional, isn't it?
I mean, it's truly pan-regional, and you learn things, and it's not trying to be anything. So it's just trying to shed a positive light on a lot of cultural things from the region.
Mm. James, while you flip through that, I wanted to. I can see you've got Vice there.
I do.
My husband's favorite.
Well, this is a title I didn't think I'd be putting forward, but I came across it yesterday for the first time in a long time. And what struck me was.
And I need to ask, where did you find it? Because I think this is one of the interesting things about Vice, because it has. Yeah, in many ways, I think sort of it punches above its weight in terms of reputation, and yet it's quite difficult to get your hands on unless you go to the right skate shop or something.
Well, I actually found it in the lobby of the Vice offices, so I can't lay claim to come across
it. But isn't it online?
It is. I think some of the content's duplicated. I mean, they have all these it's a multi-tentacled machine now, Vice, as their offices will show you. I mean, they have kind of five companies under one roof. But what struck me flicking through this in the lobby was that there seemed to be a real kind of editorial sea change as to where it was, 5-10 years ago. It was, the angsty teenagers publication of choice. And it seems to have been kind of elevated and matured editorially up to a new level. That there's genuine cultural and political commentary and human interest pieces that really, really engaged me from the get-go. There's, to a certain extent, it's still the outsider's voice, and there's a kind of healthy dose of sex, drugs, and rock and roll still very much present there. But it's been twinned with a range of generally kind of probing and thought-provoking articles. There's one on Syria in here. There's a piece on. The austerity drug of choice, the CISA that is taking over Greece, which is €2, and it's incredibly debilitating. And with everything that's going on there, it's kind of a window into, the street level scenes of Athens. There's a piece on the resurgence of the KKK, which, while sensationalist, interested me for the 5 minutes I was flicking through it. And I don't know. It just struck me that something had changed there, whether that was a conscious choice or not, whether it's a natural evolution over the years, and they've seen a shift in their readership. Given that it's a free publication, I don't know how they monitor that. but it's possibly down to the fact that they've now got Boiler Room and now they've acquired ID, and maybe that's feeding into kind of a rethink of their editorial output.
Maybe I come back and talk about it a little bit more, because it's also a fascinating business model as well, and what we've seen with HBO and other deals that they've done. In the meantime, though, you're listening to The Stack here on Monocle 24, and we're back right after this.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London. London,
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
And you're back with The Stack here on Monocle 24, where I'm joined today by Carol Corm, our Beirut correspondent, and James Wright. And we're just talking about Vice magazine before we went away to the break. I wonder if it's a case, and you're making, you made an interesting point, James, that that the editorial, the lineup had changed slightly, and I guess it sort of raises the question, is the next generation of consumer, they're living more digitally. So, I think we're also talking about they've opened up, of course, other avenues, in terms of their media quiver, I guess. And so does that mean that maybe, if they're bringing in a younger demographic, they're probably not going to this print edition, which is why they're becoming, a bit more of a general interest, news and current affairs title in many ways?
Yeah, I think that's a distinct possibility. I mean, VBS put out God knows how many pieces of video content a week. I mean, they really are a force to be reckoned with. They have significant output. And I think maybe that has facilitated that editorial change that we were speaking about. Maybe it's a luxury that they can now afford. They felt that they had to cater to their demographic in print, but now that's no longer a necessity, and they can afford to shift and alter the focus of what they choose to put out in their print publication.
It's an interesting sort of think about the business model, because there's a lot of correspondence to pay there, and I would love to sort of look at the what sort of the business plan looks like for it as well, because I can't imagine that they're getting that much for their pages, because there aren't, and
no,
I think, yeah, I mean, given sort of the level, and then there's no newsstand revenue, because it's free distribution. So,
well, the only comparable model I can draw on is what we had with Fourth and Main before the title I ran, which was a branded publication for a menswear line. It was a small capsule collection with a store in New Burg Street in Soho. And the theory behind the model was that the sales of the clothing line sustained the production of the magazine. Needless to say, we operate on a shoestring with a very small team and a small editorial budget. And if we're honest, after three issues, we realized that wasn't a sustainable model.
Right.
But maybe much like Vice, because they are now getting revenue from their online stream, they do a lot of white label stuff for brands and branded content. And, who knows what the inner workings of the company are, but I'd imagine it will be something akin to that, that the various other arms are able to sustain the production of the print publication.
We'll also talk maybe about another small title right now. Passion for Craft and Creation is something that keeps inspiring high-spec print. In Britain, a new title has just launched that takes a careful, almost nostalgic look at the quieter side of contemporary and traditional artistry. Whether it be shoemakers, cricket bat makers, or artists, Hole and Corner magazine sets out to discover the finer details of life. The new magazine also has a distinctly rural mood, perfect for today, something that seems to have great appeal for many of Britain's urbanites. Our David Pleasant, who was out on the floor a little bit earlier, we'll be hearing from him again in a moment, chatted with Hole and Corner's editor and creative director, Sam Walton, about the wonder of the woods and a lady in Norfolk who makes dollies. I think it's dollies. Yeah, I was going to say, was it doilies? No, it's dollies out of straw.
It was a project that kind of started through my train journeys to and fro for my commuting from Dorset to London, an idea which grew out of clearly a fondness and a want to be able to talk about the stories of craft behind products and objects, which is clearly a big trend that's occurring globally. And it was really that became a sort of a small idea which grew over the course of about 18 months, I guess, and really in the last 6 to 8 months has become something that's a lot more tangible, in fact, and frankly a surprise to myself and my editor that it's sitting there in front of you.
And it's a considerable volume. It's fairly thick and high quality
paper. You've obviously chosen kind of good materials, good stock here. I mean, it's got a good feel about
yeah,
it.
Yeah, I mean, there are reasons for that, and there's many reasons for that. And in terms of my side of a project like this is to make sure that I repro and print the imagery beautifully, which the photographers are, you know, is crucial to their work, and the way that our relationship would have been is to make sure that we uphold that side of the bargain for it, I guess. But it was printed locally to me in Dorset. It was printed in Frome in Somerset. The size was slightly dictated by the fact that we printed actually on the only Heidelberg in the country which can print 48 page sections, which ordinarily would be quite problematic perhaps for balancing colour and things. But actually for us, it made it affordable, and it comes with obviously a lot of other aspects in terms of energy and time that it's on the press and not wasting so much paper and various other things. So.
And talking about that craft, as it says on the front cover, celebrating craft, beauty, passion and skill. And if we can go to Dorset, imagine figuratively, yeah. It's a very kind of rural feeling of the magazine, kind of a quiet. You can almost hear a pigeon kind of cooing in the background kind of rustling in of the trees as you open. Tell us a bit about where you're based and the influence of that.
Yeah, I mean, where I live is we're in North Dorset, which is a sort of relatively untapped in terms of tourist side of things. You know, everyone heads to the coast in Dorset. In fact, everyone skips Dorset altogether and goes to Devon and Cornwall. But it's very much hardy country. It's, you know, it's incredibly hilly where I am. And yeah, absolutely, kind of getting outside has been an amazing thing. That I've, you know, the appreciation of the landscape around me, fascination with trees, suddenly all these things. I can remember kind of sniggering in a lecture at college about a guy who talked about trees. And here I am sort of 25 years later going, wow, they're really beautiful. So, you know, there's aspects of that. Mark, my editor, when I approached Mark, he had recently moved out of London and into Kent. And I knew that perhaps there were similar aspects to life in London that he was seeking, you know, to change, and also and felt that perhaps with his job and things, I thought he might be really interested in doing a project that really kind of could focus our attentions on shining a light perhaps on people and places that didn't really feature very heavily in the press.
And the focus, is it British? I mean, the stories seem to be that they have an English or British focus. Is that?
It's sort of something I kind of battled with a little bit myself. It certainly, I think when I started, I thought, you know, this is, yeah, let's focus on Britain. Everyone who wants to know about localism and the craft and then, you know, it's on our doorstep. But it occurred to me, and certainly from you guys highlighting it as well, but I mean, you know, it's a global trend. It's not something that's just happening in this country. You know, people all over the world are going about businesses in very different ways now and using the internet to reach new audiences and things. So I didn't want to restrict it to being solely a British product. You know, we have a story with Luis Liao, a New York-based Spanish painter, and there are a couple of other little bits in there. But no, it will probably still be sort of 75-80% focused on our own island.
And those stories, I have to say, my favourite is the story of this wonderful lady who makes kind of straw. I don't know what, there's a name for these things.
Well, straw dollies, although she'll hate me for saying it because she says, Sam, there's always so much more than straw dollies and everyone always focuses on straw dollies. And yeah, absolutely. I mean, I love that story. When I was first introduced to her, it was the sort of gold mine in a way. It was kind of, you know, when I started the project, it's those kind of stories that I really wanted to be able to dedicate a big amount of page space to, which again you would never be able to do in a more commercial publication. Ella Carstairs, yeah, she's fabulous. When I first called her, I was trying for days to get through to her, and it turned out that her phone hadn't been working for 3 days, and she lives in a very remote part of Norfolk, and she doesn't have the internet and no email. So when I eventually got through her to, yeah, we spent about 55 minutes on the phone. She is the first person she'd spoken to in 3 days, but she was fabulous, and I could tell, you know, she's telling me about, she's written over 70 songs. Not published, but again, something the photographer is very keen to go back and make a film about. So, but yeah, she was, you know, it's a great story, and it's a true kind of traditional craft in that respect. So I think being able to merge stories like that with perhaps a little bit more focused on things like John Lobb in London and perhaps, you know, areas that we're more familiar with, I guess.
And there is that kind of metropolitan, kind of urbane fashion kind of feel to it, but with that extreme kind of localism and that kind of cozy depiction, such as the lady who makes the straw dollies. I mean, it's a kind of wonderful juxtaposition.
I mean, it has been somewhat organic in the way it's been formed, but that certainly comes from, clearly, you know, I've worked in publishing and creative and fashion industry for quite a long time, so our contributor set is very familiar with that world. But it was really the idea that for them to be able to explore and meet people and to be able to express the way that they work and creatively with techniques that they use, but be able to work with these people was really interesting. And yeah, absolutely. I mean, that cross-pollination between those worlds is really important, I think, and to make sure that it's relevant to a London audience. But equally, it's been great to receive feedback from people that perhaps don't really pick up magazines anymore, and whether that's because they're sort of disillusioned with the way that it's gone in terms of it's so... I mean, of many comments about the volume of advertising in publications. And I think when you're so involved in the industry, as we are, you perhaps don't realise that sort of feedback. And it's been actually, you know, it's been nice to hear from people that aren't necessarily industry-based.
And that kind of leads me to my next question. It's a very difficult question for editor or magazine person to answer, but who do you think is your target reader? It's difficult to answer, especially as this is your first issue, but who's going to pick it up? Who do you have in mind?
Well, when I first was talking with my distribution agent, you know, I really wanted the magazine to be regional, you know, again, slightly because of where I'm working from and things. And I didn't want it to necessarily be a London-based or a city-based publication. But I suspect that will be where we sell most copies. You know, it has a relatively high cover price, £10. But, you know, I certainly feel that there's enough content to warrant a price like that. And certainly in terms of producing something to that standard, you know, there's no other way I could. I'd probably try to go higher, actually, but I was advised against it. So, yeah, I think we will sell to London. We will sell to urbanites who have an interest outside of town, or perhaps most people I know in London have come from, you know, living in wherever it might be, Liverpool or Suffolk or the South Coast or something, and they've moved to London to work. But they still have a lot of passion for their hometowns and things as well.
And that was our David Pleasant talking to Hole and Corner's editor and creative director, Sam Walton. And we should probably check in again with our David Pleasant just beyond the walls here at the setup for our country fair, which gets underway in about 10 minutes time here in London. And a little bit earlier, he was talking to Jeremy Leslie, who was setting up his stall. Is everyone ready to go now, David?
Everything's ready to go. We've got all the magazines on Jeremy's stall. Jeremy, give us some top tips for people who are thinking about coming to the fair. Why should they come, and what would you recommend that they pick up from your stall?
Well, aside from the obvious answer that they should pick up a copy of everything, if I were to try and specify one or two, I think I'd draw people's attention to some of the newer magazines that are available today. And I would start with, I've already mentioned Noble Rot, wine magazine, which takes a different view of wine, relating it to other cultures, music, food, life. Some very nice stuff in there, very unstuffy food wine writing. We've got the first issue of Hole and Corner, and I think you've already heard from editor Sam on that.
Prime position here. It's a lovely cover with a shoemaker's equipment. Yeah. Lovely cover there.
Lots of insight into British craft, which... is a very interesting story. It's a big story these days, and very relevant, I think, to Monocle and what the kind of coverage that Monocle itself does. We have the hot off the presses, so hot that I haven't even had a chance to flick through it. The new issue of the Gourmand,
lovely green. What would you call that? Vermilion? No, I'm not.
Vermilion. Yes, yeah. I think we'll go Vermilion.
How did you manage to get it? Why are you so privy to this?
I've relied on the support and help of cooperation of the publishers and makers of these magazines. Who've all I should thank everyone involved for agreeing to help me in this experiment today. There's magazines like the Gourmand have really gone to the extra mile to get their magazine here today.
So you really can get the first. I mean, there's nowhere else you can buy some of these magazines yet. I mean, they're the first issues.
They're the new issues.
Brand newest issues. Absolutely. Fantastic. What else can we pick up?
Well, in a similar vein, the Gourmand, the new issue of the Cereal, another very popular food magazine. Beautiful, great story in there about insects and eating insects and how you eat them and why you should eat them. But then the other end of the scale, there's I'm not even sure how to pronounce this magazine. It's either Law or LAW, Lives and Works. Is the acronym that it stands for, and that's a very interesting look at the kind of an idealistic look at working class lifestyle, working class Britain. It kind of reminds me of the Casuals from the 90s. It's looking at that age and era of fashion.
There's a few pages on old Nokia. I was looking through. There's a whole feature on those phones that people throw away. It's quite kind of contemporary youth feeling to that magazine.
Yes,
isn't
absolutely.
It?
Yeah, it's things like that and Wheel Hubs. It's this kind of things, the weird and wonderful everyday of everyday life in real Britain, rather than kind of the more glamorised Britain.
And if we want to pick up something slightly more glamorous, what might you recommend?
glamour? Well, I think the first issue of a magazine called Article is a very interesting, essentially a fashion style magazine, but it's beautifully made, and that's what drew itself to my attention. The binding and the finish, it's a real, in every sense, I mean, it is magazine as craft. It's a beautifully crafted piece of magazine making. And looking around, we've also, I had hoped to have the new issue of Put an Egg on It from Brooklyn, which is, again, is hot off the presses, but it was just a little bit too far away to get here on time. But I've got a few back issues, and there are a few little surprises there, some rarer issues.
There are some older issues there.
Yeah.
Tell us about some of those. What's this one here?
We've got a green soccer journal, delayed gratification, roulette, some of the kind of the mainstays of the British independent scene.
Okay, great. Thanks, Jeremy. And let's go back to the studio.
David, thanks very much for that. We'll be seeing you in a few minutes. I want to sort of sample on with James and Carol as well. James, Carol mentioned a little bit earlier that she likes to take the pram out of an afternoon, or at least once a week, to buy her copy of Bloomberg Business Week. What are your three must-buys? They don't have to be on the table today. I mean, what do you feel, weekly basis or monthly, you absolutely have to read? It's, life's not complete if you hadn't dipped into them.
I have to say, given the past 6 months, which have been rather helter-skelter in putting together our first issue, I find that the week is an invaluable way to keep abreast of what's going on.
You mean the week?
The week.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is. It is digestible, and I think it drills down into the specifics of what's going on in not only the UK papers but mm-hmm. globally. And I think there are some interesting kind of op-ed pieces at the back and special interest pieces. I would have to say that's probably my top publication that I read every week. I would say Inventory, which I have brought with me today, is something that I have great admiration for. Aesthetically, I think it's just beautifully pared back and understated, and it does what it does so well. I think for everything from the size, the weight, the paper.
I was in Vancouver last week and went to Ryan's shop for the first time. It's interesting. There's this little sort of inventory enclave around Gastown in Vancouver, and it's amazing what sort of happened. Very sort of different than I think anything else you find in other Canadian cities. Carol, aside from Business Week, what else do you need?
French gossip magazines. I won't reveal the names of.
It was something like EC or no? What's
that bad. I won't. Okay. I won't say.
You don't have to. You don't have to say.
I read L'Orient, so the French, the Lebanese daily.
Right.
But that's online.
But they're still doing a print edition in the country.
They do.
In market. Just before we go, there was one title with sort of the beige cover. I couldn't see the under the. Yeah, what is that one right there?
This is. It's called Portal 9. It was financed by Solidaire, which is the company that kind of rebuilt downtown Beirut. They've come up, they've given a lot of money to some very able people to do a journal. It's once a year.
Right.
It's called Portal 9. Portal 9 being like the ninth door to the city of Beirut. But it's just articles on cities in the world. And it's very beautifully done. The only issue, I think, is the font's a little bit small, but this was their first issue. It's impeccable.
Yeah, and I think for a company like Solidaire, it's quite nice. It's I guess looking at urbanism, etc., not trying to drive people to their shops.
Yeah.
In the development.
I don't know whether they will continue financing it. I'd be curious because it's so not them.
No, and one has to see, of course, how the summer performs as well. I'm going to have to leave it there, Carol Corm. Very good to see you, and hopefully we'll see more of you over the summertime. Also, James Wright, and you were just saying during the break, James. So it goes. Also, starts to roll out across Europe and elsewhere quite soon as well.
It does indeed. It's in Europe this week, and it will be in the US in 2, and the rest of the world in 4 weeks.
Excellent. Well, today's show was produced by David Pleasant. Also, Katie Bilboa has been manning the decks inside as well and keeping us running to time today. Also, our studio manager is Claire Urban. If you have any comments or queries, then do drop us a note to info@monocle.com. And remember, we're back next Saturday at this very same time. We're not sure whether we're going to be coming from this city. We might be coming from Zurich next week. We'll just see how the week unfolds. As you mentioned a little bit earlier, of course, the Monocle Country Fair is on today and tomorrow. And a big thanks to Jeremy Leslie for contributing, but also for quite literally setting up his stall here. You can also listen again via monocle.com, of course, on iTunes. But for now, for me, Tyler Brulé, it's a goodbye, and have a very good weekend. Goodbye.